It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, we're looking for beauty. You know what it feels like to recognize something beautiful? The quick inhale, the visceral punch of surprise. Who knows what sparks it? A Beethoven quartet, the Eiffel Tower, your grandmother's patchwork quilt. Well, in a handful of science labs across the country, an emerging science of neuroaesthetics aims to decode that beauty, and maybe to prove that we're hardwired for art. Here's Steve Paulson.
It seems kind of crazy to think that brain science can actually explain why we like art. I mean, think about all the different kinds of art, from Mayan sculptures to Jackson Pollock drip paintings to the minarets of a mosque, and those are just the visual arts. So can the study of the neural circuits of the brain really unlock the secrets of art?
You know, I was in a temple in India looking at these different works of art, these sculptures of gods and goddesses, and I said, this is a vital part of being human, art and aesthetics. So what's going on in your brain? Why have people not addressed this?
V.S. Ramachandran is a renowned neuroscientist. He's famous for his ingenious treatments of various neurological disorders. And a few years ago, he got to wondering if art is more than just a matter of personal taste or even cultural values. Is the appreciation of aesthetics actually hardwired in the human brain?
And I think I want to stay away from the word art, although I do use it occasionally, because art is a loaded word and there's an arbitrariness to art. It's driven by the market. It's driven by fashions and trends and historical periods. Aesthetics, on the other hand, I think you can think of universal laws of aesthetics. There are two obvious examples. One is perceptual grouping. Sometimes you see the same color repeating in a painting. The same color of azure blue in the sky repeats in a person's robe. The brain seems to enjoy grouping things that are similar. So, for example, birds in a flock flying together, you tend to group them as one big blob. That grabs your attention, and that's one of the things that artists try to do.
You said there was another obvious aesthetic law as well. What did you have in mind?
Well, there's symmetry, of course. We all find symmetry aesthetically pleasing. And the question is why? And I think it's because in the natural world, most symmetrical things are either prey, predator, or mate. They're animals, right? Mm-hmm. And these are absolutely vital for survival, prey, predator, and mate. And you want to draw your attention. That's why symmetry grabs your attention instantly and gives you a jolt of arousal.
Neuroscientists have also found that looking at symmetrical objects actually activates nerve cells in the brain. So here you have the two core ideas behind neuroaesthetics. First, our brains are hardwired to notice certain patterns like symmetry and groupings. And then these neural circuits go way back in our evolutionary history, helping us to spot lions on the African savanna or a ripe piece of fruit.
This is not to deny the tremendous role of culture. Obviously, culture plays a role. Otherwise, you would not have different artistic styles. You do have impressionism, you have expressionism, you have abstract art, you have Tibetan art, you have African art. But what I'm arguing is, as a scientist, I'm interested in principles that cut across cultural boundaries.
Well, let me just pick up on one of the styles of art that you just mentioned, abstract art. I mean, from a neuroscientist perspective, how do you make sense of our appreciation of abstract art or why people even want to make abstract art?
Now, that's a very good question. We proposed an idea to explain this some years ago. And it's based on insights drawn from ethology, study of animal behavior.
Take, for example, the common seagull, or more precisely, the baby chicks of the seagull.
The seagull chick, as soon as it hatches, it starts begging for food by pecking on its mother's beak. And the mother's beak is a long yellow thing with a red spot on it. And the chick pecks at the red spot. The mother then opens its mouth and regurgitates half-digested food into the chick's gaping mouth, and the chick is happy.
So the question is, how does the seagull chick know to peck on its mother's beak? How does it even recognize its mother? That question had stumped the pioneering ethologist Nico Tinbergen half a century ago. So he devised some fascinating experiments, at least once you get past the gruesomeness of what scientists sometimes do in their research.
So he then plucked the beak off from the mother seagull, so to speak, and waved the beak in front of the chick, and the chick still begs for food. And he said, well, that's kind of stupid. Why is the chick begging for food from this old scientist holding a beak in front of the chick? So the answer is not being stupid at all, because the goal of vision is to get away with as little computation as possible to solve the problem on hand. And in the case of the chick, what it's doing is taking a shortcut. It's saying the only time I'm going to see a long thing with a red spot on it is when I see mom.
So basically, if you give a big enough splash of color, that's going to attract attention.
That brings me to my point about abstract art. What Tinbergen found, the guy who discovered this, you don't even need a beak. You can take a stick, yellow stick with a red spot, and wave it. The chick will beg for food. But What he then found was the amazing thing. If you take a long, thin stick with three red stripes, the chick goes berserk, even though it doesn't resemble a beak. What's happening here is the chick's visual system has neurons to detect beaks optimally. So then the long stick hyperactivates these neurons. So the neurons are shouting at the top of their voice and sending signals to the emotional centers in the chick's brain saying, wow, what a sexy beak, perk up, right? So the chick gets mesmerized and prefers the stick with the three red stripes to a real beak. Now, what's this got to do with abstract art? Well, what I'm arguing is, if seagulls had an art gallery, they would hang this long stick with the three red stripes, they would worship it, pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for it, and call it a Picasso, call it a great work of art. And that's what we're all doing when you're looking at semi-abstract art. You're titillating these neural circuits in the brain, form-detecting or color-detecting circuits in the brain. I think what the clever artist is doing is creating the equivalent for your brain of the stick with the three red stripes for the chick's brain.
Okay, we're trying to determine if a few universal laws of aesthetics actually cut across all cultures, all historical periods. That's the fundamental premise of neuroaesthetics. So let's jump from Ramachandran's baby seagulls to Vienna around 1900, a city that had a remarkable artistic and scientific flourishing, where Freud launched his revolutionary ideas about the unconscious, where Schoenberg developed his atonal music, and abstract expressionists created a new kind of art. This period fascinates the Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel. In his book The Age of Insight, Kandel sets out to uncover the secrets of the three great painters of abstract expressionism, Gustav Klimt, Oskar Kokoschka, and Egon Schiele.
They actually made the point that the purpose of art is not to convey beauty, but to convey truth. And what you see in Klimt as a transitional figure, but Kokoschka and Schiele are full-blown expressionists, they introduce this dramatic art form with a conscious attempt to depict unconscious mental processes.
So how did they do it? How did these great Viennese painters tap into the roiling inner psyches of turn-of-the-century Vienna to render it so memorably on the canvas? Eric Kandel says neuroscience can help us explain the mystery.
I am a reductionist in my science. A common strategy in science is to take a fascinating, complex problem, select a simple example, and I've tried to do that here. I focus just on portraiture, because we know a great deal about how faces are represented in the brain, and on only three artists that make up the Vienna Modernists.
It turns out the brain has its own neural circuitry for looking at faces, not only so we can recognize other people, but also so we have some sense of what they're thinking and feeling. It's what scientists call theory of mind, the capacity to get inside the heads of other people.
First of all, we know there's an area in the brain called the inferior temporal cortex that specializes in faces. How do we know that? If you have a lesion in that area, you're face blind. If you look in that area, if you do an imaging experiment on a monkey and you show that monkey a picture of a monkey, there are six patches of cells that light up. In each one of those patches, 95% respond only to faces. They not only respond to the picture of the monkey, but they respond even more dramatically if you make a cartoon. Now, that's the first suggestion of expressionism. A cartoon is an exaggeration. It's a distortion of the picture. And what Klimt, Schiele, and Kokoschka found out is if you distort, people respond more powerfully. And then they actually experimented with it. They moved the eyes further apart. They moved the eyes closer together. They made even more of a caricature out of it, and the cells went wild.
Well, you know, there's going to be a reaction that a lot of people have to what you're saying. Don't try to reduce art to neurons and brain chemistry and all of that. I mean, keep scientific reductionism out of the creative process. It will reduce the magic of what makes us human, what makes us creative.
I think that's a very valid point, and we have to think about this. I think the purpose in trying to bridge between art and science is not to replace the human response, the magic of art, but to give you a new dimension. Leonardo da Vinci dissected corpses in order to understand how the various bones fit together and how the muscles fit onto the bones, so you can have a more realistic depiction of the body. So knowing more about how the body and the brain works enriches your understanding without in any way dehumanizing it or reducing it.
But it raises the question of how far can you dig down into this process? I mean, are you talking about by looking at the level of neurons and synaptic connections, you can actually understand the creative process in some primal way?
One would hope so. I see absolutely no roadblock at the moment. Now, this is a long distance away. We are talking half a century, maybe more, but we're making progress. We understand certain primitive correlates of creativity. That isn't going to make us more creative, but we're going to understand a little bit more about the biological nature of creativity.
I have to say I find Eric Kendall's faith in brain science kind of contagious. And it's not surprising that we're now seeing this new field of neuroaesthetics. After all, we're living in the age of neuroscience, a period of remarkable discoveries about the brain. But not everyone with a scientific bent is convinced that brain science can explain why we like art or why we seem to need it in our lives.
I'm not opposed to reductionism per se, but I think that neuroaesthetics as a field thinks that they are doing more than they can actually do.
Ellen Dissanayake is an independent scholar who has spent much of her life trying to find the connections between science and art. She draws on various disciplines, from anthropology to evolutionary history, but her own fascination with these questions goes back to a watershed moment many years ago.
It started when I was an undergraduate and I heard her Schubert Quintet and found myself crying during the slow movement. It was a kind of experience I had never had before. Not wrenching, because it wasn't displeasure, but it was just kind of more than one can actually encompass or believe could be possible with a work of art.
So what is this experience of art? Why does it have such power to transport us? The folks in neuroaesthetics would say it all goes back to our brain's preferences for certain colors or shapes or patterns. But Dissanayake calls this neuroaesthetics, as if pinpointing the brain's preferences for red over gray has much to tell us about the nuanced and sometimes overwhelming experience of art.
Our brains are not just making reflex responses. If that were so, then a Playboy centerfold picture would be the height of aesthetic excellence because it pushes all of the buttons for our adaptive choices of males, at least.
Dissanayake thinks part of the problem with neuroaesthetics is a Eurocentric bias towards art museums and concert halls, the masterpieces of Western art. If we really want to understand the origins of art, she thinks we're better off looking at pre-modern cultures, especially the ritual ceremonies when the whole tribe comes together, singing and dancing and drumming, often wearing masks and painting their bodies.
By emphasizing these uncertain events like birth and death and going out for the hunt or to battle and everything, these are all very serious concerns that people feel uncertain about.
So, for instance, if they're going out for a hunt or maybe going into battle, they would have some sort of ceremony basically to get jazzed, so they're ready to do this. So they're sort of in some heightened state to be able to go off and encounter the unknown.
That's true. And oxytocin is known to be a suppressor of cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So you could say, or I hypothesize, that their moving together in time produces the trust hormone, oxytocin, which makes people feel unified and confident and trustful.
Partly what you're saying is art ultimately sparks an emotional response. I mean, this is not something we necessarily reason out. It hits us in some visceral way.
Yes, it does. People's emotions are not just pleasurable or beautiful, the way the neuroaesthetics people would say, but they tend to be very persuasive and memorable.
Let's face it, encountering a work of art can be one of the most moving and mysterious experiences we can have. I do wonder whether science will ever get to the bottom of it. But even V.S. Ramachandran, one of the gurus of neuroaesthetics, says we've just barely begun to scratch the surface of what science can tell us.
I think right now 1% or less is explained by neuroscience. But I think a time will come. I think you'll maybe understand 10, 20% of it. To me, it's that 20% that's valuable because I'm a scientist.
Steve Paulson with neuroscientists V.S. Ramachandran and Eric Kandel and art historian Ellen Dissanayake. You know, beauty has been a subject for philosophers as far back as Socrates, and they're still at it today. A few years ago, the eminent Italian novelist and philosopher Umberto Eco wrote A History of Beauty, which he followed up with a study of ugliness. Here's what he found.
I graduated with a thesis on aesthetics, so it seems that the problem of beauty was always central to me and to my reflections. Listen, when I made this book on beauty, I believed it was, well, absolutely funny to do it, because, you know, it's a kind of book you have to make a lot of research to find images. But when I started the ugliness, I discovered that beauty is very boring, and on the contrary, ugliness is very exciting. But for a very simple reason. First of all, beauty is more predictable. Even from the point, a theoretical point of view, many philosophers have written about beauty. Even though the notion of beauty changes through the centuries, there is always involved an element of detachment, contemplation without a desire. I can contemplate a flower without wanting to eat it or to have it in my hands or to destroy it. That's the contemplation of beauty. While with ugliness, there are a kind of ugliness that can be contemplated, but there is another that provoke disgust, in which you have not the aesthetic detachment. You have a sort of passional involvement. So in this sense, the phenomenology of ugliness is more complicated than the simple contrary of beauty. The ugliness is infinite. Obviously, from the beginning of the Western civilization in ancient Greece, there was the absolute identification of beauty and virtue and moral goodness, and so, by contrast, of evil and ugliness. But also since the beginning, the suspicion that there are cases in which the external ugliness can conceal moral qualities. According to Hegel, the ugliness enter the religious paintings with the Christianism because they had to represent the tortured body of Christ. While in the Greek tradition, the gods were beautiful. Christ was the first religious figure that was represented as suffering. That's as being a sort of 360 degrees rotation of the concept of ugliness, so that in our era it's very difficult to distinguish ugliness from beauty, because there is a sort of, I called it polytheism, both of beauty and ugliness. There is no more a single God, but there is a plurality. But I think that when saying so, people is exaggerating, because we still have the notion of the absolute ugliness when we see on the TV screen people tortured and killed. We still know what is the absolute ugliness.
Umberto Eco is an Italian semiotician and novelist, author of The Name of the Rose and Foucault's Pendulum. You can hear more from him on our website, ttbook.org. There's more beauty coming up on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Among the most enduring lines of poetry ever written are these: beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. John Keats wrote those lines in the early 1800s. These days, beauty's got a more complicated reputation. But Harvard literary scholar Elaine Scarry is trying to give the concept a makeover. So first off, what do we mean when we talk about beauty?
When we speak about beauty, sometimes we're talking about the beautiful object itself, which could be a child's face, or it could be a beautiful glass vase, or it could be a flower. Sometimes when we talk about beauty, what we're talking about is the experience that happens to us when we come into the presence of something beautiful. And over the centuries, we've had many gorgeous accounts of that, you know, starting with Plato's Phaedrus, in which we have a description of Socrates seeing a beautiful boy, breaking into a sweat, his knees buckle, he feels in his shoulder blades a prickling because he's beginning to grow wings as he begins to recall the immortal realm from which he's come. And then sometimes when we talk about beauty, what we're talking about is, again, what happens within the psyche of the beholder, but now not what happens just within the first few seconds, but what happens more enduringly. Just going back to Plato, for example, Socrates says that his teacher, a woman named Diotima, told him that beauty gives rise to the desire to bring children into the world, that when you see somebody beautiful, it creates the desire to create biologically, to create children. But Diotima then tells Socrates it also gives rise to the desire to create legal treatises, poems, philosophical tracts, and so forth. And that idea that the beautiful brings about in us the desire to create is longstanding and occurs over many centuries.
Do you think that's true, that experiencing something beautiful awakens in us a desire or need to create, to add something to the world?
I do. I absolutely do. Wittgenstein said, when the eye sees something beautiful, the hand wants to draw it. You want to replicate the thing you've seen. And it may be, if one has a disposition towards drawing or a talent for drawing, that one does exactly what he says. But even if one doesn't have that, one carries out that act of replication by, for example, telling a friend about it or wanting to take a photograph of it.
See, I think of that as, I keep remembering the poet Wordsworth in college, and there's a very famous line about the desire to render something back, to give back. I think
Right. What
you're talking about is gratitude.
Well, that's a wonderful description of it. I would still say that it's an act of creation, that it awakens in one the desire to give back, to give thanks. But that requires an act of creation, whether it's a material act or a verbal act. You know, Wordsworth in Tintern Abbey says, what is it that happens to you when you look at these beautiful symmetrical structures? And he says that what it leads to is the little unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Though those are acts of gratitude or acts of thanks, they're also acts of creation because it's multiplied the beautiful itself.
I'm curious, have you ever heard a piece of music that was so beautiful it brought tears to your eyes? I mean, I have often. And what do you think that is? I mean, what happens when we encounter something so beautiful?
Well, I gave the description that Plato provides, that you're being brought into contact with the immortal. And even if one doesn't oneself believe in an immortal realm, I think that we would probably agree with Plato that we're sometimes, by beautiful things, put into contact with a metaphysical realm, or maybe one could say with our own best selves or with something greater than ourselves. There's a description that's given by two mid-20th century women philosophers. One is Iris Murdoch and the other is Simone Weil, both of whom say that when you come into the presence of something beautiful, you undergo an unselfing. Iris Murdoch talks about the fact that she's sitting there being preoccupied by the fact that maybe the world, maybe her colleagues, maybe her friends aren't treating her as well as she deserves. And then suddenly she sees a beautiful bird lift off the ground, but she could have easily said she suddenly hears a piece of music. And she says, "And I undergo an unselfing. Suddenly I move to the periphery of my own world. I'm emptied of self." Simone Weil, the French mystic, said something very similar. She said, "We undergo a radical decentering." And I use an awkward term for this, which is opiated adjacency. And yeah, it's not a pretty term, but it's a very sensible term, because here's what it is. I say, there are lots of things in the world that give us acute pleasure. There are also lots of things in the world that make us feel marginal. But there's almost nothing other than beauty that does those two things simultaneously, that gives us acute pleasure at the very moment that it makes us feel marginal and happy to be on the margins, to stand back, to listen to the piece of music and just feel awe at what has been created.
So you've written that moments when we're just stopped in our tracks by something beautiful can make us see the rest of the world with fresh eyes. What did you mean?
I think that beautiful people and beautiful events raise our standard of perception. Sometimes people worry that a beautiful vase or a beautiful person will rob your attention from everyone else. The easiest case is you'll give inordinate attention to the beautiful person and not pay attention to those who don't strike you as equally beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I think the opposite in the long run is true. The next time you're stopped in your tracks by someone beautiful, ask yourself, were you walking along the street generously paying attention to people, or were you not paying attention to anyone? And then suddenly, like getting knocked on the head, awakened and made to give full attention. And then the next step is to say, but everybody deserves this level of attention, or that's the way one should perceive when one is being alive and alert, using the beautiful, whether in the realm of persons or the realm of music or poems, as a standard for greater care that should be distributed in general.
You titled your book On Beauty and Being Just, suggesting that you think there's a connection between beauty and justice?
I think there's a very strong connection between beauty and justice. I was surprised to learn that the word for fairness in the realm of justice, so in the realm of like fair arrangements, actually comes from the word fairness in the aesthetic realm, meaning loveliness of countenance or perfection of fit. If you think about each of the three sites of beauty that we talked about earlier, you can see the pressure towards justice in any of them. So, for example, in the case of the beautiful object, that beautiful object will have features such as symmetry, vivacity, clarity, unity, that I think anticipate those same features in the world of justice. And I use the example of symmetry. There have been great mathematical analyses of the strange mathematical workings out of the arrangement of both petals and leaves on plants, etc. That anticipates the much more difficult to bring about symmetry in the world of justice. There's a very famous 20th century account of justice by John Rawls, in which he describes fairness as requiring a symmetry in all our relations with one another. In fact, if one looks at accounts of justice from all different periods and all different philosophers, it almost always entails symmetry. So Plato talked about the fact that there ought to be a symmetry between crimes and punishments. To me, the opposite of beauty, I never use the word ugliness, I don't quite understand what it is, but I understand injury as an opposite to beauty. Somebody might worry, well, if we say that injury is the opposite of beauty, does that mean then if my legs both break, does that mean that I'm outside the realm of beauty? Well, here's what I think the answer to that is. Human beings have to be opposed to injury. They have to, when they look at injury, recoil. That may mean if they look at me with broken legs, they don't see me as beautiful, they recoil. But that actually in the long run is a good thing because it means that we try to stop injuries, and if we see an injury, we say we've got to do everything we can to repair it. Mm-hmm. And if we can't repair her legs, then we're going to redesign our city so that walking on one's legs isn't as important. We'll put ramps on buses. We'll put ramps into buildings. Hmm. But we have to remain opposed to injury. So I think part of what's happening when we look at the beautiful is, in fact, an aversion to injury. Now, for a while, biologists were claiming that other creatures that choose their mates on the basis of their beautiful feathers or their beautiful display or their beautiful songs or the beautiful nests they can weave, that they're doing that in part because it convinces them that their mate is very healthy and will have healthy offspring.
Right, I so think it's there's really been, utilitarian.
Yeah, and it shows that there is an association, even in the non-human world, with non-injury and beauty, that symmetrical wings on the butterfly are the best predictor of a capacity to endure in the world without injury.
Elaine Scarry is a literary scholar at Harvard. Her book is called On Beauty and Being Just. You can hear my uncut conversation with her, including her thoughts on why in academia talking about beauty has sometimes been taboo. That's on our website, ttbook.org. Where do you go when you're looking for beauty? To the beach? The woods? Your family? Across the street from our studios, there is an art museum. And some days when I'm tired or I need some inspiration, I go find something to look at for a while. It could be a Japanese print or a Greek vase or an impressionist painting, just something that strikes me as beautiful. This month, a new show went up at the Milwaukee Art Museum, all about folk art. Most of the works were donated by sculptor and collector Michael Hall, and our producer Sarah Nix took a trip to Milwaukee to talk with him about the beauty behind folk art.
Michael Hall is standing in front of a whirligig. You've probably seen them in garden stores or front yards. There's often a man rowing or a cyclist carved out of wood, but this whirligig is monumental.
It's 6 feet long. It's about 3.5, 4 feet tall. How many figures do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's 11 active figures on there, and all the little carved and assembled propellers were set to turn in the wind, and then all of the figures on the teeter-totters and on the merry-go-rounds would move as the thing, you know, gathered wind.
Hall and his ex-wife found it in the mid-60s, lashed to a gift shop in rural Pennsylvania. He says it's a defining example of American folk art. But is it beautiful? I don't know. It's not finely crafted like the Italian glass of the gallery next door. It doesn't glow like the gold-leafed religious icons the museum's got in storage. Hall and his ex-wife collected folk art like this whirligig for decades before donating it all to the museum. This piece is called The Sporting World.
It's beautiful because it's so empowered. It really represents that spirit of folk art, the handmade, the fun, the unexpected. And with the little American flag and the little flag target at the back, it's got the patriotism that folk art always encodes when it's good.
And the whirligig is charming. It looks like someone's grandfather or uncle made it. Maybe it was a wedding present or a weather vane for perching on top of the family barn. There's no wind in the gallery, but I can imagine the jugglers and teeter-totters in motion. Whoever made it back in the 1900s, they had fun doing it. Paul walks me through the gallery to a collection of 8 carvings. Against a bright red wall, it's the fall of man. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, they're these unpainted blocky figures. The tree of life is an awkward fountain of fruit with a black snake wrapped around the trunk. Hall doesn't talk much about beauty in front of these carvings. Instead, he talks about how they were in a New York sculpture show beside ancient Greek marble statues, a Giacometti bronze figure, and a Donald Judd Stack piece.
There's a new audience for this piece, but it took a while for a contemporary art audience to step up to folk art. I believe this is a work of great genius.
Why is it a work of great genius?
Because ostensibly it's just these sort of doll-like figures set up in these moments of a Bible story. Everyone in the world at one time or another has looked at a photograph of the Sistine ceiling or stood in the Sistine Chapel and looked up and been overwhelmed by the power of Michelangelo's way of telling a story that we really all know quite well. And the choices that he made as an artist makes it special, makes it profound, makes it unique. This is the same kind of thing, but it's a piece that is still gathering an audience because it's a difficult piece. This is where folk art gets interesting. And this is where folk art gets beautiful, to me.
The man who carved these is Edgar Tolson, and Hall tells me about him, a Kentucky man, his life, his faith, his family. And I start to wonder if part of what makes a thing beautiful is the story of who made it and how. In another part of the gallery, Hall walks up to a big landscape painting. It's the gateway to Yosemite, with craggy mountains and boulders tumbling down to a muddy river. To be honest, if I saw the painting at a garage sale, I wouldn't give it a second look. No one knows anything about the person who painted it, except that the last name was Bickmore and that he or she probably had no training. So there's no personal story to give the painting oomph. But Tolson says it tells a different kind of tale.
The picture is dated 1876. 1876 would have been the centennial. Americans are still trying to get used to their country, building a very powerful mythology about their country. Also a voyage of discovery, initiated, of course, by Lewis and Clark, but followed up by artists. And so by 1876, the American art world was busy trying to sort of capture the amazement that they experienced in the midst of the wilderness, in the presence of the divine, in the presence of the proof that this was indeed a favored place, a blessed land with a destiny.
And facing the majesty of Yosemite, in a breathtaking valley, Bickmore did what you do and what I do with our cameras and our blogs and our travel stories. Bickmore shared the beauty of the place and painted all the dreams of a young America that the wilderness brought into focus.
Look what he's done. The mountains just become bigger than big. There's layers of them, like layers of stage curtains that endlessly go off into a horizon where if you follow the river back, you know, where will you end up? You know, might you not end up in the presence of God? I think this artist, that's why I came over here, this artist was really trying to capture magic, magnificence, something bigger than himself. These are all the typical triggers that we talk about when we talk about an aesthetic experience. You know, this is supposed to be a pretty picture, but more importantly, it's supposed to be a magnificent fantasy powered by more than just the artist's vision, but a whole cultural mindset. The painter is us, and this is one of the things that folk art will do. It goes often to these kind of obvious sources and tells us something that we already know, but tells it to us in a new way that makes it fresh. And for me, I suppose that comprises the quality of beauty that I find in folk art. Beauty is an idea before it ever is paint on canvas or before it's wooden figures carved out of poplar branches.
That's Sarah Nix with sculptor and collector Michael Hall. The Folk Art Show at the Milwaukee Art Museum will be up till May. You'll find more information about looking for beauty on our website, ttbook.org. And coming up, realist writer Juno Diaz tells us why he's a science fiction fan. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Ruth Ozeki, and a book which I would really like to recommend is Kamikaze Diaries, Reflections of Japanese Student Soldiers by Emiko Onuki Tierney. It's an analysis of the diaries and letters written by Japanese students who were conscripted and forced to join the Tokotai, or the kamikaze forces. In America, of course, when you talk about kamikaze, it has such a strong connotation, and the stereotyping of it, of that word, has become the predominant image that we have of these young men. But in fact, a lot of the pilots who were conscripted were really the creme de la creme of young Japanese intellectuals. They were, you know, fluent in many European languages. They read French poetry. They read German philosophy. They were able to think about and to discuss and to write about the moral and ethical problems of war and the challenges that they faced in a way that I found absolutely heartbreaking and really interesting. The young men who are writing these letters and diaries are so present on the page. They really emerge as these sensitive, young, intelligent men confronting death. And not only confronting death, but confronting the worst possible kind of death, knowing that their death will be contributing to the war. Many of them were opposed to the war. And, you know, as somebody who grew up, you know, I was a child in the post-World War II years. You know, I was born in 1956, which was only 11 years after the war had ended. And so I grew up, you know, with very, very strong anti-Japanese propagandistic images still that were very much a part of, you know, the culture, you know, during my childhood. So to read, you know, these incredibly articulate, you know, heartbreaking letters and diaries by these young kamikaze fighters really sort of opened my eyes, too, to the horrors of that war and the horrors of military conscription and military culture. And so, you know, it's a book that I think is, you know, incredibly important.
Ruth Ozeki's novels include My Year of Meats and A Tale for the Time Being, which was a finalist for the 2013 Man Booker Prize. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Ruth Ozeki on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, science fiction. We're running a sci-fi flash fiction contest, and Steve Paulson's here to tell us about it.
Now, flash fiction means short, so we're looking for stories that are 500 to 600 words long and based on real science.
3-minute futures, right?
That's right. So the premise is these are stories that are about hard science, so scientifically plausible scenarios for the near future, stories that might deal with the future of energy or computing, robotics.
And so the finalists are going to be chosen by, we're very proud of this, Kim Stanley Robinson. He's the author of the Mars Trilogy. He's a legendary science fiction writer. And then dramatized
by Gates McFadden. You will remember her as Dr. Beverly Crusher on Star Trek's The Next Generation. She also runs the Ensemble Studio Theater in Los Angeles, and they will be adapting these stories for radio. And
the winning stories.
The winning stories.
The three winning stories.
Yes.
Okay, so quick recap. If people want to take part in our flash fiction contest, they go to the website, ttbook.org. All the details are there. And remember, the deadline is coming up soon. It's March 1st. And so, Steve, in case people need a little inspiration, you also brought someone in to talk about science fiction, right?
Yes. Juno Diaz, who is a major figure in literary fiction. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Well, it turns out he is also a huge fan of science fiction, which I had not realized.
I'm kind of very promiscuous in my love of literatures, of genres. Certainly, there is no question that I love the genres of science fiction, of horror, of fantasy. And when I was writing my first book, Drown, I was simultaneously writing a fantasy novel, which I finished and got contracted. But, you know, in the end, the books have never kind of fallen into the shape I want them to. I think in this way, my kind of literary fiction perfectionism is probably doing me in, There's something about the form that I find really inviting and I think really productive. It allows me to sort of address issues I wouldn't be able to address with realism. So I've been drawn to them.
What kinds of issues can you address in science fiction that you couldn't in the sort of the more, quote, conventional literary novel?
Well, I mean, how many literary novels do you know are about breeding people?
Not that many.
Yeah, well, I'm a product of a couple hundred years of white folks breeding black folks to work. And, I mean, think about it. There's very few black folks in this hemisphere who aren't the product of this sort of sinister experiment of breeding human beings. Now, this is not something that realism is capable really of addressing as well as the genres. Now, you look at realistic novels, the reality of the African diasporic experience is almost entirely absent. Yet you look at science fiction, and science fiction is always breeding people.
So, for instance, the mutant, the one of those standard science fiction tropes, I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about here, I suppose.
Sure. But, I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, breeding experiments are in many ways a kind of one of the great standard features in science fiction stories. And the reason the reason that this is a feature is because the hidden history of our reality, what we can't say in polite or realistic discourse, me and you don't like to think, no one likes to think that we are all took part of this really messed up, horrific, inhuman breeding experiment. Now, we can't say that, but popular culture, what we call the genres, often are able to articulate in altered forms the hidden histories of our nations. And so I think that that's, something that is very attractive to me, because I'm always interested in the silences. I'm always interested in what the things people and cultures can't say. And I think a lot of those silences are broken in rather altered ways in the genres.
It sounds like you're saying that in some ways, genres like science fiction can take on big ideas that realistic fiction really can't.
I just think that in the end, we need multiple frames, multiple lenses to express or interpret our world. The idea that we could understand our entire reality through realism is absurd. I think that science fiction is as important a way of theorizing about the world.
Well, I want to ask you about a story of yours that was published in The New Yorker, I guess an excerpt from the science fiction novel you're working on, Monstro, which features very large zombies in Haiti. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of a book that sort of ground to a halt. I don't know where to take it. Again, it was supposed to be a book about monsters and more importantly, a book about the island that I was born in, an island which has been the site of all the great important invasions that made and remade and broke our world. When you think about the conquest, as it's euphemistically called, that sort of transforms our world into the new world. It begins on this island. I mean, the Dominican Republic and Haiti are kind of, they are like a top 40 list of invasions. And so in my mind, I couldn't help but think, man, if there's going to be an alien invasion, how much do you bet it's going to happen in the most invaded land in the world?
Well, and then you get, of course, this, practically apocalyptic earthquake in Haiti, which, I don't know, must add extra dimensions to this kind of story that you've been thinking about.
Well, certainly. I mean, my poor island, the apocalypse has visited us so regularly, we can describe it as part of our weather.
Now, you teach a class on apocalyptic literature at MIT, right?
Oh, yeah, man. That's my bag, man. I love the apocalypse. Come on, man. I was 11 when Reagan was elected. There's no greater apocalyptic tutelage, I would argue, in the present era than to have grown up under the shadow of Ronald Reagan. He was my Dr. Manhattan. He was like my looming end of the world. That rhetoric he had of like, we will bomb the Russians into dust, and it doesn't matter if 99% of us get killed, we will win. That was just immensely scary to a young person like me.
Yeah. So who are you? Who are some of your favorite apocalyptic writers?
Oh, man. I have a lot of the classics. I have a lot of the classics. I adore Octavia Butler. I mean, every one of her books has an apocalypse. Samuel R. Delaney's Dahlgren is one of the great phantasmagorical sort of postmodern apocalyptic novels. John Wyndham is the guy who's kind of accused of the cozy apocalypses. He's the guy who wrote The Midwich Cuckoo, Chrysalis, and, you know, another writer who was overwhelmingly obsessed with apocalypses. And so on and so on. There were so many growing up. I mean, that's the thing, that there was an embarrassment of riches.
Well, and then now, I mean, yes, there have always been these stories around, but now we're sort of, we seem to be in this apocalyptic or dystopian moment. I mean, everywhere you look, on TV, movies, YA books, literature, there are these stories. So what's going on now, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think this is, certainly this seems to be another one of those moments where the interest in apocalyptic narrative and the sort of apocalyptic zeitgeist in the culture is reaching a crescendo. You know, ideas and stories and narratives go into circulation. We're at one of these peak moments in apocalypticism. And I think this has a lot to do with our anxieties. This has a lot to do with perhaps the sense that the future is blockaded. I mean, we don't have a kind of a future-minded national project. Most of us are being told that the future is something to be overwhelmingly scared of. The future is possible terrorist attack. The future is not that we're going to save the planet. The future is that the environment is going to degrade and our sort of malign habits are going to do us in. The future is not that we're going to step up as a species and transform the world into a paradise. And I think that it's not an accident that at a time when elites have most overwhelmingly trampled our rights, that the stories that are most in circulation are stories that are so demotivating. They're not stories about us stepping up to the plate and taking power. They're all stories about things are going to get worse, so don't cause any trouble. Don't trigger this. And for elites, these stories must be incredibly valuable because they're not stories that exactly incite people to take risks, to dream big. And, you know, I think that if I was kind of a powerful person, one of these gilded elites who has so thrived in these climates and environments of inequality, I think that these would be my favorite stories right now because, wow, they keep people scared, they keep them in their place, and they keep them from noticing me robbing the country and the world.
That is a great place to end it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Junot Diaz won the Pulitzer for his novel The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. His most recent novel is called This Is How You Lose Her. If you want more information about our sci-fi short story competition, you'll find it on our homepage, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, which comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen and Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.